This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. 10 years ago, Champlain College took a leap and said video and online gaming was a legit major. The school became the first in the nation to offer a 4-year degree in gaming. Now it's far more commonplace, and gaming continues to be a booming business. From Angry Birds to World of Warcraft, there are all kinds of ways people game, and independent game developers say the wide accessibility is giving them more chances to strike it big, or even just to make a living in their craft. So what's Vermont's role in the gaming industry? And what do some of the people who've been immersed in this world for more than a decade think about all the changing pieces? Today on the show, we're going to take a look. I'm joined now by Anne DeMarle, founder of the Game Degrees at Champlain College. She's Associate Dean and Director of the Emergent Media Center and its new Maker Lab, and of the Master's Degree in Emergent Media in Burlington and in Shanghai, China. Hello again, Anne. Nice to have you on the program.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
And we're also joined today by Amanda Crispell. She's Program Director of Game Design and Assistant Dean of Game Development for Champlain College's Game Studio. Nice to have you back on the program, Amanda.
Nice to see you again, Jane.
All right. So, Anne, I want to take us back 10 years now to when the gaming degree was started. And just if you can recall what it was like, what the reception was in college circles around the country when Champlain said, we're going to offer a 4-year degree in this.
Well, it was an interesting time. There was a couple of other colleges starting to investigate or had launched 2-year degrees. So it was pretty phenomenal because, as you stated, people said, is this a serious game? Is this a slacker game degree? But what a realization of mine had been from working with people in the industry is some of the brightest people in the world work in the industry. They have to be complex thinkers. So the next biggest challenge for Champlain was, and Amanda could probably speak still about this, is allowing parents to understand what world that their young people were about to venture into. It was a challenge for Champlain because it became the biggest degree at the campus, and the growth was phenomenal. So how do you address those needs internally as well as externally? I'm really proud to say that even though there's over 500 programs now in game development, through Amanda's leadership, we're still in the top 20 consistently.
In the country, you mean?
Yes, in the country.
So Anne was mentioning that this has grown exponentially. I think, Amanda, there were something like 34 people in the first degree class, and now
Correct.
There's like 450?
Yes. And we'll probably be over 500 in the fall next year.
Wow. So it is huge for the
school. It
is huge.
And
Anne was saying parents haven't always understood that this is, I imagine the students coming in say, I know why I want to do this, and this is legitimate. I'm learning about technology. I'm learning about art. I'm learning about design. There's probably some social science going into it as well. What are parents thinking?
So 9 years ago when I first started, parents were dubious about what we were offering, and we really had to do a pretty clear sell on what were the employment opportunities. I'd say that the tide has shifted, but it's not completely shifted. So every year when families come on campus for Accepted Student Day, which we just had last weekend, I do a pretty extensive component of our presentation that is about jobs, about where jobs are, what salaries look like, what is job security? And that usually combined with Champlain's quality, just education in general, sort of makes the sale.
Is there a lot of job security in the gaming industry?
It's a little bit different. It's not like some jobs where you expect to go have that job and you're going to have it for the rest of your life. And actually, there are very few of those jobs anymore. I also teach a class that helps them prepare for the future. And I have them read this article called The 4-Year Career. And some of them get a little panicked because most people these days make some kind of shift within that first 4 years. So in the game industry, there is job security, but there's a reason why there's large hubs. So there's different parts of the industry. In the entertainment industry, you have, like, for example, have a large hub in Montreal where we have a campus, and there's a large hub in LA, and there's several others in the United States. People do shift around between companies because they'll get a lot of jobs for a project, and then that project ends, and then there'll be layoffs. But that's happening everywhere, so there's security, but it's not probably the same security that some people think about when they think of that word.
But there are transferable skills that they're learning, you
absolutely
think?
And you know, the average age of the game industry still is only about 35. That tells you that a lot of people do leave the game industry. And I've been in the game industry for a long time. I have lots of friends who stayed and some who have gone. And those skills are very transferable because anywhere where we're making interactive media, software, all of the skills that our students are learning are applicable.
So, Anne Morrell, the Champlain College recently opened a Maker Lab, mm-hmm. and I assume this is building on the Maker movement. We've talked about that here on the show. What are students doing in the Maker Lab?
Wow. So all sorts of things, everything from making musical instruments to devices with LEDs to one of my favorite projects was from one of our MFA students. And she created she understood that children with autism, severe autism, have to wear helmets, and it's to protect them from headbanging episodes. And so she took apart a game system. She she electronically altered a helmet and then made it so that on a web interface it would alert caregivers before the episode occurred so they could intervene before the child got out of control. So, I mean, that it goes from that extreme. I look at it right now as a playful space. We're demonstrating tonight. Actually, we have a show where the students have created something with Oculus Rift, and you can fly.
I would like to do that.
Yeah, it's fun.
And so, do you see ties here between the Maker movement and this ability to create new things with technology and the gaming industry?
Oh, definitely. I was thinking because one of my favorite games is actually Animal Crossing, which I'm addicted to, and it's on a little DS, and that form isn't really as prevalent anymore. But I keep thinking about how they foresaw that we would be using these mobile devices, and now mobile devices include our Fitbits, and
Anne is holding up her Fitbit,
yeah, my Fitbit
on her wrist,
which I love because going back to Amanda's thinking about competencies and transferable skills, these are game devices, Fitbits. They set you goals. They give you points and badges. That's all skills that a game designer is learning and employs daily. And now we're seeing it throughout our life. So I think Fitbits are a perfect example of the combination of makers and games or game thinking applied to how we interact.
We're talking today about gaming and the gaming industry. We're talking at the moment with two of the movers and shakers at Champlain College who think about this stuff all the time, Anne Morrell and Amanda Crispell. And listeners, we'd love to hear from you. If you think about gaming as an industry, does it seem trivial to you? Do you just think, oh man, all those people wasting time with Angry Birds? Or do you see it as something else, something transformative, skills that are transferable, like Anne was just telling us about? And maybe you work in the field or you have some really pointed thoughts on some of the games that you play. You can share them with us. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. We're also going to talk about women in gaming and some of the really ugly gender politics on display in the field. So if you have a thought on that, go to the Vermont Edition Facebook page and weigh in. We did ask on Facebook, do you think games are trivial? And Becky says, I don't think you can call games any more or less trivial than any other pastime or hobby, especially a hobby that 67% of American households say they participate in. So, you know, this is a field that you both work in. But Amanda, I come up against this idea that games are just trivial wastes of time that people are playing while waiting for the bus or when they should be doing something more useful.
Right. Like the 15 minutes I wasted while I was waiting to come in to meet you all.
So what were you playing?
Puzzles and Dragons. That's my nemesis. This is what I tell my students. The power of games, and it doesn't matter what kind of game it is, just think about the simplest game of tic-tac-toe and the very first time you played it. There's one thing you had to do in order to play. You had to learn. And whether you're in World of Warcraft and learning how to optimize and maximize your characters and all those stats, or you're playing a simple puzzle game like Tetris or Sudoku, you're learning. And that power of learning, I think, is what academics has cracked open and created some success around, because now we can look at how games can be used to make you healthy, how games can be used to help with autism. All of these things that we're beginning to understand about why we play. We've been playing games as long as we've been recording and telling stories, and most likely before that. We've been playing games longer than we have been artists or anything else. It's in our nature to play. It's part of being a mammal. So this is very much part of who we are as humans, and to disregard it as something trivial is a mistake. And so I want my students to understand that they have a very powerful tool in their hands, and then they need to be responsible for the things that they make. Sometimes we make things that other people object to, and I never say to a student, you can't make this thing, but I always say you have to stand behind your own ideas. And if you're going to create something that's controversial, you have to be willing to take the heat, and you have to be able to defend your position.
And do you have students who have done that? Can you give me an example of one game that perhaps, or one idea that you thought, boy, I really don't like that, but I respect the student's right to do it?
So early on at Champlain, I think it was only my second year teaching, I had a student write a game narrative that I found disturbing. And it had images of violence in it, and I didn't personally like the way women were portrayed in this narrative. And so we talked about that. And I said, as an instructor, I'm going to be as objective as I can and look at the work as a design, but you also have to remember that I'm a woman and I'm a human and I'm going to respond emotionally to the things you make. So we had that conversation about, you know, being responsible. And so I've always stuck by that sort of principle. And usually when I'm teaching a design class where I have open-ended, you can make whatever you want, I always give that little speech. You know, just know that if something startles me, I'm going to look more closely at it. And then if it's not good design, if it's just there to startle me, that's out in my design principles. That's something that shouldn't be in the design because it has no purpose.
Let's go to Neil, who's calling in from Colchester. Hi, Neil. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I work for a local high-tech company called Polhemus, and we make products that are used in gaming. In fact, we've donated some of this to Champlain College. We make motion tracking sensors and 3D laser scanners. And I just wanted to comment that with regards to the prior comments about job skills and, you know, is there employment in this? And one aspect of gaming that is absolutely booming is in the area of what's called serious games or things like simulation, training simulators, for example, medical training simulators with mannequins to teach ultrasound. And these all use gaming technology, virtual reality environments, motion tracking. And I can tell you that the market for these simulation trainers is exploding, particularly in medicine. So it's a great thing.
Neil, thanks for that call. I appreciate hearing from you and working in the field, what you see coming out of the gaming industry. We were just talking a little bit about some of the things that might disturb you in games, but also some of the ways that games can be used to teach, for us to learn. And tomorrow, one of the things that has come out of Champlain College, and I think we talked about it several years ago now, is a game called Breakaway. Mm-hmm. And that's a soccer-based game mm-hmm. that is designed to talk about gender inequity and violence against women. How does that actually work, though, to do any good? I mean, do you have any evidence that games that are designed as games for social good actually do any?
Sure. I could actually talk about two different projects from the EMC, Emergent Media Center. And I just want to preface it by saying it's an important component of our education at Champlain because we empower our students to empower other people through this medium. So one game we did was actually partnering with the University of Vermont for children with cystic fibrosis. And so what was wonderful about that game, we were just looking to increase their motivation. It, like the caller from Polhemus was saying, on a medical reason. So children didn't like to do their breathing exercises. So working with the UVM professor and working with John Cohn from IBM, we actually took the breathing device and were able to make it so that they would play games for their exercises. And through that study, we found that not only did it increase motivation, which was what we were looking for, it also increased lung capacity. So that's one example. Breakaway, I can now report, due in part from our incredible students who have kept this project alive, we've taken it both to Palestine and we've taken it twice to El Salvador and worked with youth there. Thing about El Salvador, we go, it has the highest per capita murder rate of women in the world, which is pretty amazing to even just consider. Through a study we've done with the University of Vermont the first year, which was 2013, we found that that game actually increased both awareness, so awareness was the lowest level we were looking for, but all the way up to suggesting that they were changing their behavior. And part of the reason that game worked that way, it's harder to change behavior, but we worked with Population Media Center and applied this methodology called the Sabita methodology, which part of that is about role modeling. So the game, you actually make decisions, but you behavior is modeled, and the children then copied that modeling.
You know, that game Breakaway, as I said and as you mentioned, Anne, is really designed to address some inequities in the way women are treated and certainly violence against women. The gaming industry does not have a very good reputation when it comes to women within it. And I'm not going to go down the rabbit hole that is Gamergate. This is something that came out a year or so ago, but except to say that it was this sort of internal controversy that leaked out as well about the role of women in games and game journalism ethics. But a lot of what came out of it was people thinking that there were young, angry white men who didn't like the idea of other kinds of people coming in and being part of the game developing world. So, Amanda, how do you address that issue of women in games and the perception, at least, if not the reality in many circles, that women are not always made to feel welcome?
So one thing I'd like to point out about that particular topic is if you look at the game development industry and the loudest voices coming out of that space when it comes to Gamergate, it pretty much unanimously fell on the side of that we want women, we respect women, and we need to do more. A lot of the angriness, I think, came more from the consumer side, not entirely, but the majority it was on the consumer side. And I think there's some interesting social dynamics going on there. And you'll see, I think, also examples in other male cultures. There's some interesting tweets going around about Monet Davis. It was awful. And then some things about Kurt Schilling's daughter. And I think, again, those are social examples of a male-dominated space that is being changed and that there's anger over that change and that spilled out. Now, that all being said, at Champlain, we had those conversations too, and we had students on both sides. What came out of the whole conversation, first of all, I was very happy about the level of maturity that people were discussing this in spaces like Facebook, which can really get out of control. We rarely had to say to someone, maybe you should reconsider how you're saying that. We didn't want to shut down what they were saying, but how you were saying it. But what's the outcome has been a much more open conversation about what is the objectification of women? How are women treated in the game industry? We've seen a growth in our women and diversity game group. They're a special interest group of our Champlain College Game Developers Association. So in general, while it was this horrible thing that happened, it really brought the topic to the forefront, and now it's actually discussed more. I see more students saying to other students, why does your character model look this way? She doesn't look strong. She looks this way. Maybe you should look at this body instead of that body, you know, for your model. So it's been interesting and positive overall.
Although still a slow change. I mean, listeners may remember just a week or two ago now hearing a story on NPR about a girl who was playing some of these games and found that every time she wanted to have a female avatar, she had to pay more to download the female character rather than the sort of default male character, which was free or cheaper. And so, you know, it's still who these games are geared to may be shifting slowly.
Yeah, so the markets are shifting. I think by the time my 8-year-old is, you know, has children, I think we're going to just see a flatness to the gender differences.
You do, really?
I do think we will, just because, you know, we see so many, just the smallest kids now, 2 and 3 years old, are playing games on iPhones and game playing is becoming more of a just part of what everyone is doing. What's shifted is the type of games and the types of markets that will develop. And we play differently. Women play differently than men. Boys play differently than girls. We're going to have games that separate us by gender. I think we are trying to, at an academic level, change the demographics. We directly recruit women. We put a special effort at Champlain to have a more diverse population. Like right now in game art and animation, our incoming freshman class is about 50% women. Considering the game industry is only about 15% women in the game art space, that's pretty good. Now we're closer in game programming and game design. We're much more closely aligned with the game industry, but we're working on that. And I think as academics, as games get leveled as something that everyone does, and as academics and the institutions and the way we recruit students to our institutions gets a hold of games as academics, I think we're going to start feeding more diverse people to the game industry, and hopefully that will help institute the change.
All right, we're talking today about the gaming industry. We're talking with some local game people who have thought about this a lot. You know, it's a far cry now from when people used to have to go to the arcade and play Pac-Man by throwing a few quarters into that big machine. I mean, now we have it all at our fingertips. If you have a smartphone, you can play games. That does allow as well some independent developers to get their games into the hands of people who might not otherwise have seen them. And we're going to talk to one of those, a local developer, coming right up here on Vermont Edition. And if you have a thought to share, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're taking a look at the gaming industry from a local angle with Amanda Crispell and Anne DeMarle of Champlain College. That was the first school in the nation to start a four-year gaming degree program. Listeners, if you're a gamer, do you seek out smaller independent games? How do you find them, and how do you figure out what you might want to play? Or maybe you're a casual gamer jumping on the bandwagon of the next big trend. Tell us if you see Vermont as the next tech hub for aspiring game developers. Call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. We've been talking about some of the broad themes emerging in the gaming world at the moment, but right here in Vermont, there are independent game developers trying to make a splash in that world. Daniel Moore is one of them. He's the founder of Tunava Games in Burlington. Tunava is the maker of Epic Nights, a mobile game set on the St. Michael's College campus that the company produced for the school. And he's currently working on a survival crafting game inspired by the Vermont wilderness. Daniel, what a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
So tell me a little bit about this game that you're developing now called The Wild, and what about Vermont inspired it?
So I have been living in Vermont now for about 7 years. I came up here after studying at Kennesaw State and business technology there. And for me, in terms of gaming, Vermont has arguably the most beautiful landscape to produce something. So first off, at Tunava, we consider ourselves to be a post-Minecraft studio. That means that we view Minecraft as a paradigm shift in gaming. It starts with a sandbox experience in which the player can do absolutely anything they want to do in the world. We set up basic mechanics so that they can craft and survive, but the onus for us is on a really rich, beautiful survival experience. So we think Vermont really provides a convergence point for doing that. So The Wild, for instance, you just start out at the middle of an island, which we've set up kind of like Lake Champlain, and you survive. There are no tutorials. There are no hints. You just figure out what you want to do. And so we call these post-Minecraft products because we've seen just the emergence, the sheer popularity of Minecraft in this space. If you've seen, Minecraft has been in the top three now for on the App Store for at least 3 years. So we view it as a really big push in the gaming industry.
Let's go to some of the calls. We've got a lot of people who want to weigh in here as well. Abby is calling in from St. Johnsbury. Hi, Abby. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah. Go right ahead.
I wanted to talk about how playing video games with my husband has really improved our communication. We have this game called Borderlands, and there are three different sequels and so on of it. And you know, when we play, it's a first-person shooter game, and there are a lot of enemies. And, of course, we like to play on the hardest mode. And it's really important for us to talk about, you know, who's going where, who's taking what flank, and who's taking what enemies, or, you know, if you get down and you need help. So, you know, I found that when we're not playing well, we're obviously not communicating well. So that's, you know, that's really helped us improve our communication in that way. Not to mention that the game is really great because it has an incredibly diverse cast of characters, and it's hilarious. So it's something we're both really passionate about.
Abby, thanks for sharing that, really sort of twisting that idea or the cliche on its head that if you're playing video games, you are not communicating, or you're sitting there next to your partner not talking. Abby says it's improving communication with her husband. And when Abby mentioned Borderlands, Daniel, you like put up your fist in the air like, oh, yeah, that's a great one.
Yeah, so Borderlands is a great product. It has a lot of the open world sandbox style features that I like in a game. It's a game that I've actually seen a lot of other couples play, so this is actually not a unique piece. It was really interesting. Borderlands has this very interesting cel-shaded design, which I think is really, really cool. And it's something where people like to talk about the game. There are many, many ways in which to play the product. I think that's a trend we're seeing overall in the market, too, in the industry, is it's no longer linear gameplay. This is something, again, where I see Minecraft leading the way. There are so many ways to play a particular product, and I think it makes it really interesting, and it's a fresh approach to the otherwise linear-style gameplay.
Daniel, you're here in Vermont. You know, we heard from Amanda a few minutes ago that one of the tech hubs, one of the gaming hubs in the entertainment side of things is in Montreal. Why not live there and, you know, come spend weekends in Vermont? Why not be in the center of this industry?
Yeah, so I think arguably Montreal is important because of Ubisoft. They are a very large company. The thing, though, about why we're in Vermont doing this here is we're at a new point in gaming where mobile has gone from basically 0% of share to almost 37% of share, estimated in 2017. They're about 25% now. This is a billion-dollar industry. It's something in which one can do with one partner, which I have, Clay. We do this at Starbucks. We do this in the forests. We do this on our MacBook Pros with very little internet connection. We use a tool called Unity 3D, which I'm sure our guests also know about. Unity, it basically gives anyone the opportunity to prototype very quickly, so we see between digital distribution on the App Store, low barrier to entry with technology with Unity, all one really needs to do is come up with a good game plan to make that happen. Places like TouchArcade.com gave us the opportunity to test out various prototypes for our first post-Minecraft product, and that's where we came across what we felt was the best one, which was The Wild, based on the Vermont wilderness.
And Amaral, do you see Vermont as being able to attract more people like Daniel Moore and people who want to work in this field? I mean, there is this degree program at Champlain College, and now it's several degrees within the program, but Vermont, you know, still sometimes struggling to be the tech hub that the governor wants it to be and that many Vermonters would like to see.
Yeah, I think it's an issue I've been working on as long as I've been at Champlain, partially because I hate losing our graduates and they do leave. I think the success of Champlain at drawing these students here is an indicator that Vermont could be successful. There's a lot of structures that need to be in place.
Like,
Montreal has done Quebec has done a great job because they've put in financial incentives that have drawn the industries there and created the hub that Amanda was talking about where people could move around. I think the same thing applies to Vermont. We have some pretty strong tech industries, but we need to be able to encourage them further so that the employees can move. You know, careers usually or jobs usually last 3 to 5 years these days, especially in technology. So to create an environment where employees can move from company to company and bring in more diverse talent, and it really ups our game because of the experiences that they can share and grow from. So in order to do so, I think a couple of directions have started. I'm really encouraged about the different incubators that have gone up that allow these cooperative working situations. I think there has to be more of how can you put in a place where young single people can hang out, you know, where they can get together. And
so more maker spaces.
More maker spaces like Generator, like the one we have. So those common community areas, financial incentives would help. What's interesting in Quebec is that incentive is coming to the end, but now that industry is so strong there, they're not leaving.
Let's go to John calling in from Barrie. Hi, John. Go right ahead.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
It's a question. A woman asked earlier about the increase in women in the gaming profession. And the question was, women being programming for games reduce the violence in the games, or will the gaming change women to be more violent?
John, thanks for the call. Oh, Anne is chomping at the bit to answer this one.
Yeah, I just want to share an interesting experiment. So one of the preeminent game designers in the world is Will Wright, and you probably might know him from his work on The Sims. And he did a really interesting experiment that he shared at a conference. And that is, he created a robot, and he landed in a street, and he pushed it over on its side. And then he recorded as people approached the robot. So what it was really interesting, he said that if men went by, so there's two kinds of men. Some of them would walk rapidly by. Other ones would start picking it apart for pieces. He said if women walked by, they tended to go to the other side of the street and get away from it. He said when men and women were in groups, they went and helped and picked it up. And it had a phone number that you could call. So I really don't have an opinion about which way. I think that's an interesting question. I do think when we have diversity, whether it's gender diversity or ethnic diversity, it does tend to bring in new viewpoints and new perspectives, and I actually think it can bring us to a better place with things we haven't even thought of yet.
Amanda, weigh in here. What do you think?
So I agree with Anne. I think diversity definitely changes a workplace. It opens up thinking. I don't think women are going to start thinking more like men, or men are going to start thinking more about women. But when you have multiple voices, then different opinions can come forward. So I'll give a story about a project we worked on. So this is Breakaway, early days, and we were doing character design. And the students came back with character designs for the protagonist, who is supposed to be about a 11, 12, 13 at the most, year old girl. And they showed the designs, and they were all males that had drawn them. And this 13-year-old had the body of maybe a 20-year-old, and with very large breasts and curves. And I said, now, wait a minute. Let's think about this. Let's go actually look at pictures of what 11, 12, 13-year-old girl looks like. And why did you go in this direction? And that's because at that time, we had a diverse group working on that project. We could bring those viewpoints up.
Right. So you don't know what viewpoints you're missing if you don't have other people weighing in.
Exactly.
Daniel, I want to ask you, this is something, you know, you can hear it in your voice. Clearly, you are passionate about what you do and passionate about the gaming industry. Do you think this is something that you can make a living at, doing this small, independent gaming on your own? Or is the bigger goal to move to one of those big game studios?
Yeah, so I have no intention, or I don't have a goal of going to work, or doing this and going to like a launching point. That's not why I'm doing this. I had a great opportunity with Launch VT and Peak Pitch. We had an advisor come in and tell us, try to create a monopoly. And what he meant by that was try to create something where 50,000 people absolutely love what you're doing. And so on Touch Arcade, we saw an enormous, I think we're something at 500,000 views on Touch Arcade. We knew we were onto something. So I view this more as a post-Minecraft studios. There are many of these now on PC. I see a lot of value in doing it on the App Store on mobile. It's called Core Gaming because it's just more. It's a more immersive, longer duration gameplay session experience. It's very underserved on the App Store. That's where I'm really betting on. And we don't need. There's nothing about needing some huge valuation of the company to make that happen. We just need a good plan and just really hammer it out from there.
So you see yourself in this field for a long time then?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Elon Musk said earlier he's charging behind Tesla and SpaceX. Gaming was what got him into the space. So gaming is immensely it's a creative avenue. I studied philosophy. I view philosophy and gaming very similarly. They have a lot of strengths, and it's up to each individual to try to flesh out what particular pieces from that they want to move forward with their career. But absolutely, I want to do post-Minecraft for a long time to come.
That's Daniel Moore. He's the founder of Tanuva Games in Burlington. He's working on a game called The Wild, so keep an eye out for it. We've also been talking with Amanda Crispell, Program Director of Game Design and Assistant Dean of Game Development for Champlain College's Game Studio, and Anne DeMarle, who founded the Game Degrees at the college. She's Associate Dean and Director of the Emergent Media Center. Thank you both for being on the program, and Daniel, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, Vermont's poet laureate Sidney Lee reflects on the power of poetry to connect all kinds of people. You're listening to Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. April is National Poetry Month, and poetry enthusiasts around Vermont have embraced the occasion with readings and new publications. This month is also when nominations are open for Vermont's next poet laureate. The four-year term comes with a whopping $1,000 honorarium, but it does give the appointed poet a chance to spread the word about his craft. Vermont's current laureate, Sidney Lee of Newbury, has spent his time promoting the literary forum at libraries around the state. He'll retire from the position in a few months when the next poet laureate takes the helm. So we checked in to see how he's reflecting on his tenure.
Oh, I've really liked it. I've really liked it a lot. As you know, traveling to community libraries, I've done, I think, 107 of them. Every visit has been a treat and a novelty in some unanticipated way each time. So I've really had a good time in this position, and hope that I may have carried the torch for poetry a little bit. Needless to say, given the kind of fare that one sees in a lot of the glossy magazines nowadays, people may be well inclined, and I include myself in that company, to think that poetry is nutty and incomprehensible.
But not so, you think?
Well, I've tried to wave the banner for another kind of poetry, which also exists out there, practiced by the likes of my pal Ellen Bryant Voigt and other poets like B.H. Fairchild, and they're all kind of Wesley McNair, the poet laureate of Maine, is still writing poems that people can actually understand and I think be moved by.
And, of course, Ellen Bryant Voigt also in the hallowed halls of...
She is indeed.
Vermont Poet Laureates. Poets Laureate, excuse me. You know, when you started, I remember we were talking about all the libraries that you wanted to make sure you got to, and you were hoping to reach all of them, weren't you?
I was, and I fell short of that mission, although I visited over 100 of them. Certain number, I suppose. Well, obviously, that weren't interested, but those that were interested always managed to bring reasonable crowds, even in the smallest of towns, and always seemed to have people on hand who were genuinely curious and interested and interesting in themselves. So it's been a great experience. It's amongst other things, it's sort of steeled me in my Vermont chauvinism. This is a great place with a lot of great people in it.
I imagine when you do these events, you get people who bring their own poems to you.
In some cases, for the most part, what I've done has been to go and talk about poetry, and not merely read my own work, but to read other people's work as well, and then to speak about what I think poetry can accomplish that maybe other modes of discourse cannot, and also to demystify it a little bit. You know, I think so many people, including myself until rather late along in my life as beginning poets go, so many of us are discouraged by the way we're taught poetry. We're always supposed to look at it as, you know, a vehicle for symbolism or what students always like to call deeper meanings or messages or ideas, you know, and that takes a little bit of the play and the artfulness out of poetry and the mystery out of poetry. I don't think that poetry is reducible to messages. I always loved the great predecessor's comment, Robert Frost said, if you're looking for a message, call Western Union.
You know, it's hard, though, because there's this sense that if it is truly accessible and open to everybody and loved by everybody, it's not as good.
Well, I know that's, but I think that you know, and I, mind you, I speak as a veteran of 43 years of academia myself, so I'm not trying to be sanctimonious because sometimes I err in this, have erred in the past in this direction myself. But, you know, the notion that poetry that isn't difficult has somehow to be a poetry that's been dumbed down is simply nonsense. You know, I was speaking of Ellen's poems. I mean, they're entirely accessible in the sense that everybody can get something out of them on first reading, and yet they repay every bit of attention you can give them over years of scrutiny. And the same with Frost. If anybody thinks that Frost is a simple-minded poet, they just haven't read him very carefully.
So, Sid, you've still got a couple more months left. This is, I guess, sort of your lame duck portion of your 4 years. What do you still want to accomplish?
Well, I've got, I think, five more libraries lined up. I continue to write my monthly columns for Burlington Free Press, the Times Argus, and the Valley News over in our part of the state. I keep really being energized by my conversations with people at the libraries. I find that somehow or another their curiosity and sometimes even their confusion seems oddly generative to me. It seems to make me want to write more and more accessibly. So there's a way in which being poet laureate profoundly affected my life in the sense that it introduced me to a whole lot of people whom I might not otherwise have met. But there's also a way in which my life has remained very much the same. I'm still a poet first and foremost, I suppose, at least in the artistic dimension of my life. I'm also a doting parent and now grandparent five times over. So there always seems plenty to do, and the rest of life goes on, and I'm enjoying it to the full. You know, at 72, it makes good sense to keep one's eye on the present.
Well, and of course, there's, I think it's what, $1,000 honorarium you receive, so that's clearly a life changer as well.
Well, yes, of course, I bought that condo down in Acapulco with that right away, lest I spend it all in one place elsewhere.
So the applications presumably are rolling in for the next Poet Laureate, or the nominations, I should say. What advice do you have for the next person who takes the helm?
Well, you know, it's hard for me to advise because, I mean, there's such a range of people. I haven't seen any of the nominations. I've been tapped for the selection committee, which I will happily serve on. But there are a vast slew of sort of middle-aged poets and even some younger poets. And then one of my favorite poets in the state is Jean Connor. She'll turn 97 this summer. So, you know, my immediate predecessor, Ruth Stone, is a marvelous writer. I'm so glad that she got that honor. But being appointed at 92 and being blind to boot, there was not a lot she could do. So I think it'll depend a lot on the interests and the energies of whoever succeeds me. But I would hope, not necessarily following in my footsteps with libraries, but that the next Poet Laureate would seek venues which were not conventional. And I was really particularly interested in taking poetry into other venues. There's lots of stuff out there. There are prisons, there are high schools, there are even elementary schools. Indeed, yesterday I went up and visited my granddaughter's first grade elementary school class at Champlain Elementary. I have to confess, I was more nervous going into that class than I was when I read before the Library of Congress. But
kids are a tough audience.
So I hope the next he or she will be his or her own man or woman, but I hope that they will keep that notion alive, that to be the state poet means that you're talking to as wide a sampling of Vermont citizenry as you're able to manage, whatever your strategy may be.
Sidney Lee is Vermont's Poet Laureate for another 6 months or so. Sid, thank you very much for talking with us.
Always good to talk to you, Jane. Bye-bye.
Vermont's previous Poets Laureate were Ruth Stone, Grace Paley, Ellen Bryant Voigt, Louis Gluck, Galway Connell, and Robert Frost. The Vermont Arts Council is accepting nominations for the next Poet Laureate to join their esteemed ranks. We have a link for details at vpr.net. And that's it for today. Tomorrow, the leader of the state Senate, John Campbell, will be here. The House is pushing for mandatory school consolidation, but the Senate is taking a softer view. That's one of the issues on the table for tomorrow's discussion. You can join us for that at noon and send your questions to vermontedition@vpr.net. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sam Gail Rosen, with production assistance from Aaron Lucy. Mary Williams directed the show. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. And our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.